Welcome to The Machine, a computer science education podcast from the Southeast Technological University. I'm your host, Rob O'Connor. Today I'm speaking with two individuals. One is Bernard Butler. He's a lecturer and researcher here at the college. And also Takshila Verege, who is Bernard's graduate student. They're both working on the Vistamilk project, and they're looking at how wireless networking is used in farming. And also how that can be used to support agriculture on Mars. We'll get to the Mars part in a bit, but we might define what the project is first. First off, lads, you're very, very welcome.
Thanks, Rob.
What is Vistamilk?
I could take that one. So Vistamilk is an SFI-funded research centre. So it has a number of different academic partners and industry partners. And it's all about the dairy industry. So it's looking at the cows, it's looking at the farming practices, the way that food is derived from cows, the way that cows are, you know, managed, maintained, kept healthy, all that kind of thing. And it's basically doing research in that area, often with an applied focus.
Okay, so this is a computer science education podcast. You're both here with your Walton Institute hats on. Yeah. Takshila, you're actually wearing a Walton top.
Yeah.
So your branding is A1. How does a technological centre end up being concerned about dairy farming?
So essentially, dairy farming is an example of what's called an application domain. So obviously, everyone, you know, likes to put milk in their cereal in the morning. So one of the things that we want to look at is how to do that in a better way, whether that's for the environment, whether it's for the animals, whether it's in terms of lowering costs. We believe that information and communication technologies can help in that regard. So information and communication technologies would be things like wireless networking and the various services and devices that work with that.
Could either of you give us an example as to how that fits, how that, you know, because that can sound abstract. How does wireless networking help with milk production? Takshila?
Yeah, I'll take that question. So in our research, what we do is we develop the wireless technology. So mainly we focused on 6G communication. So we try to find the value-added functionalities that 6G telecommunication infrastructures can provide to not just for communication, but like for sensing. So
can I just stop in as you said, so 6G. So this is the next one on from 5G, is it? Okay, absolutely. Right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so we mainly focus on detecting gases, like atmospheric gases. So, for example, in farming environment, particular cattle release methane gas, like 200 pounds of methane gas per year. So, if we can detect those gases by using these wireless infrastructures, and by analyzing the signals, so that will be a value-added functionality, and we can reduce a large cost that we spend on sensors. So this is not like sensing a particular place. This is like sensing a particular area.
Yeah. Okay, I'd need to dig into that to find out where. So you're looking at how telecommunication signals can be used to detect a particular gas. Yes. In this case, you're talking about methane.
Yeah.
How does that work, and how do you arrive at that? How does somebody think, do you know what? I think I'll use wireless communication signals to sense gas. How do you arrive at that at that point?
I can take one part of that, and I think actually we'll follow on. But so essentially, what we're doing there is we're looking at wireless communications as essentially something that's just in the environment. So the question then is, okay, it's providing a communication service, but can it do something else, particularly if these wireless communication systems are expensive to deploy? So if it can provide other services, then it's kind of, you get a better return on investment. And then the question is, what can it do? So one of the things, as Takshila mentioned, is that using it to sense gases. So that's that's where we're using the wireless communications itself, infrastructure itself, to sense other uses of wireless communications, just to collect data, say, on animal movement. And that will be essentially all what's happening there, is that we're just using wireless communications as a means of getting the data from one place to another. So what Takshila just mentioned there is actually using the wireless communications infrastructure, the devices, the signals and so on, and using them as sensing.
Okay, so we're surrounded by these invisible radio signals.
Yes.
They're everywhere.
Yes.
And they have been for a significant period of time, and they're increasing as well.
Yes.
So normally people are using them for watching YouTube videos on their phone, or sending messages to each other via whatever platform, or
yes,
you're just doing your normal internet-y stuff.
Yes.
And the idea, so they're there, and the idea is to piggyback on those and say, what else can we do with these signals now that they're there? So I'm going to give you an example now, which might be totally wrong, and if it is wrong, tell me it's wrong.
Okay.
So you see, now I don't know much about physics, but I'm trying to remember back, like, you know, the Doppler effect.
Yes.
So the Doppler effect has been used to measure distance.
Yes.
So you know, people would know, you know, you hear an ambulance going by, Nino, yeah, Nino, 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 Nino. But you can do something like that, and you can measure how far things away are. And that's been used in a lot of space research to measure,
yeah,
the distance.
Or
of
even on Earth, you see them,
yeah,
speed traps for you know, for driving. You,
yeah,
know.
So that's a kind of a physical phenomenon, and then it is being applied in,
yes,
certain ways. Is it the same kind of concept here, that these radio signals are there, they have one purpose, but they might also be able to be used for something else?
That's the right idea, yeah.
So is it that the physical properties of the signal change when they're exposed to certain gases? Is
exactly,
that correct?
Exactly.
Okay, so Takshila, could you explain,
yeah,
how that works,
yeah,
and where this fits in? It's almost like Star Trek stuff, sorry.
Sorry, I'll start answering like in this way, like to use terahertz frequency range for its communication. And this terahertz frequency range lie between millimeter wave and infrared wave. So the frequency range for the terahertz is like 0.1 terahertz to 10 terahertz, like that's 100 gigahertz to 10,000 gigahertz. This terahertz frequency range have many important characteristics. Like its large bandwidth availability will provide hundreds of gigabit per second data rate. That's like 100 times greater than that we have now, like in 5G. Mm. So, and it's a shorter wavelength. Like its wavelength is in between 30 micrometers to 3 millimeters. So because of this small wavelength, we will be able to create a miniature communication devices. And also the because of the same reasons, these gas molecules size is approximately equal to the wavelength of the terahertz frequency. So because of that, when this terahertz frequency propagate through the atmosphere, so it will severely attenuate because of this gas molecule, especially, mm, because of water vapor from our investigation. So we can use that loss to detect gases. Each particular gas show a unique spectrum. If we take the terahertz frequency like 0.1 to 1 terahertz, it will show high molecular absorption in particular frequencies. So we can use those frequencies to sense these gases.
When we talk about sensing, what we're talking about there is, as Takshila says, there's absorption at certain frequencies. So think of that as being like a fingerprint of the gas. Mm.
Yeah.
So different gases have characteristic fingerprints. And then you see how much of that absorption is happening. So using mathematics and signal processing, you can estimate the concentration of different gases. So there's always going to be some carbon dioxide or methane or other types of gases in the atmosphere. And then what you're interested in is where it might be surprisingly high. So one of the concerns with farming is that, you know, cows, to put it mildly, they belch and they produce carbon dioxide and methane. And these are gases which are known to have a greenhouse effect. And that's not obviously not a good thing. So You can, if you wish, you can put sensors specific for these gases, but they will measure locally. So they'll say, at this corner of the field, this is how much gas you have, okay? What's the advantage of what Takshila has described is that you're doing spatial measurement. So you can measure gases over the entire field rather than at particular points in the field. And that gives you a much better kind of handle on how well farming is doing in terms of either reducing or increasing its greenhouse emissions.
So again, I'm only just trying to get my head around this. So the idea is that there will be sensors placed at various locations around the farm.
Yeah.
And you would get these snapshots as to the atmospheric conditions.
Yes.
Of the very hyper-local of the farm. This particular field has, we detect that maybe there's a little bit more carbon in this field than this field over here.
Yeah.
And maybe that might be a signal to the farmer to, hey, do you know what? Maybe that field needs to be left alone for a while.
Yes.
And
exactly.
Maybe we might move the cows over here.
Exactly.
Or this field has excess nitrogen or whatever whatever other things it might
exactly.
be.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
So think of these devices as forming a network. So you have signals being passed directionally between them. So you measure along each line, essentially. And that line goes across the field and you can kind of measure, roughly speaking, what's happening in that field. And if you had, say, different treatments, different types of fertilizer usage or different grazing practices or whatever it is, you can kind of say, well, just as you say, it's hyper-local. I can know that certain things work well on my farm. And then you could potentially report to an auditing service that says, look, you know, this farm is actually, you know, using best practices.
Yes.
And as a result, you know, if there is any kind of carbon credits and so on, you can take account of it then.
Okay. Yeah, so it can be, it's not a, often you listen to the news or whatever, you hear farmers have been beaten over the head with sticks. It's not about that. It's about maybe actually rewarding somebody.
Rewarding good practices.
Okay.
And then if I was a farmer, I can sort of point to the fact that I've got, you know, I'm doing better than average, for example.
Yes.
And there's, and yeah, it's good for the environment as a result.
We might also kind of head off problems before they arise.
Exactly.
You know, like for example, I know I don't have a farm background, I haven't a clue, right? But if something is changing in this particular area of the farm and maybe you're aware of it a little bit earlier,
yes,
you can take a corrective action.
Exactly.
That's minor rather than something major that is required later on.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. What would be the skills that would, what are the disciplines that kind of underpin this research that you're doing? Takshila? You know, imagine if a computing student was listening to this and they're thinking, well, you know, what do I need to know or what do you need to know in order to engage in this kind of work?
Yeah. So basically, we need the knowledge of how electromagnetic wave propagate through the atmosphere, like through the gas molecules. Mm. So and we need some basics about mathematics as well. So when these electromagnetic waves propagate through the atmosphere, that means among the gas molecules. So these gas molecules absorb some of the energy that transmit through a transmitter in the direction of a receiver. So this absorption this energy will convert into a kinetic energy when this gas molecule vibrates. So that's what we call a molecular absorption loss. So by using that molecular absorption loss, so we can develop some kind of multiple linear regression model, right? So by using that, we can detect a targeted gas, if we need to detect methane concentration on the atmosphere, so we can target that gas and we can do some simulation and detect those gases.
So you're talking physics and mathematics there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And simulation as well as computing, because you're typically using large scale computing resources to keep running systems many, many times over.
Yeah.
And then you're collecting data and then you're using statistical kind of processing on that.
Okay. So would this be kind of I hate to say data mining, right? Because I know you teach data mining, but it would be that kind of thing, yeah?
Yeah, some of the techniques will be related to what happens in data mining.
Okay. Would there also be a certain element of kind of IoT, Internet of Things, things like, I mean, you mentioned these sensors. So do you build these sensors? Or are you involved in the building of these sensors? But the skills that would be, I'm thinking, right, so first off, they have to be very, very small. Yeah. They have to be efficient in terms of power. Yes. You can't plug them into the mains in a field. So that would involve very efficient coding, yes, for example.
So we don't actually get involved in this project in the physical devices level. But you're absolutely right. I'm involved in another project which is looking at the energy management of these devices. And the idea here is that, as you said, they're wireless because you're not going to be able to run a wire out into a field or up a mountain. So the issue there is, you know, if you have a physical device, you have to provide it with the resources it needs. Like you said, efficient coding is very important. And particularly because these devices are, the primary purpose is actually communications. And we're, if you like, we're asking them to do something extra. So we can't be taking resources away from their primary role, which is communications.
Yeah.
So having a awareness of, you know, memory and CPU usage and all the other kind of things are necessary. And the other thing about these devices is that they often have to meet very strict kind of standards. So being able to develop, you know, reliable software engineering and not break things, essentially, is very important as well. So it's not so much in this project, but certainly if we were to take it to the next level, the software engineering aspects would definitely need a lot of attention.
So what you're doing is you're taking a whole gamut of, I say, basic disciplines and pulling them together in this very applied fashion.
Yes.
Right. Now, I want to ask you, because I hinted at Mars at the start, right? How is this, how are you attacking Martian agriculture onto this? So either of you, whoever wants to go with this, because when I spoke to you about this a while ago, Bernard, and it genuinely did sound like something from a science fiction novel, a good science fiction novel.
Yeah.
how does this work?
Yeah. So basically with Mars, I suppose that the thing about doing this on Earth is that there are practical challenges. And one of the big challenges on Earth is, as Sixila mentioned, molecular absorption. So molecular absorption is a bugbear of terahertz communication. So terahertz communications, as Sakshila says, has a huge amount of advantages, but its big disadvantage is that if you have moist air, the terahertz signals are badly absorbed. So that you typically don't get more than a few tens of meters of distance before everything just sounds like noise. It's just like static hiss. So basically what happens there, if you go to an environment on Earth and you try and suck out all the water vapor, you can do some testing on that. But in some ways, the easiest place to test would be somewhere which is extremely dry. And Mars is extremely dry. It's a dry, dusty world. It also has very little atmosphere. Like compared to Earth, I think it's 0.6%. of the atmospheric pressure. So it's a great place, if you like, to develop and test devices from this perspective, much more easily done than on Earth. So we could work in a kind of like a Martian laboratory. The other side of it would be if we have, and hopefully we will eventually have, people living on Mars, the likelihood is that they will live in isolated habitats. So a habitat is like a self-contained community. The problem with that is, okay, it's great from the point of view you have a community, you have your doctor, you have your baker and all these other sort of people, but the isolation could become a problem. So having extremely good communications support, you know, so that different habitats could stay in contact with each other is very important. So one of the things we're looking at is if you wanted to get to this point where the, you know, you could have sort of telepresence. So imagine, it sounds a bit Star Trek-y, and I apologize for this, but
please be as Star Trek-y as you want.
So if you wanted to have some sort of a communications device which allowed you say, to be in one habitat and someone else to be in another habitat, maybe several kilometres distant, and for them to have a hologram in your room and you to appear as a hologram in their room, then the feeling is that you would, you know, the scope for interaction and make it more realistic and more, you know, engaging is much greater. So like when we went through the various lockdowns, you know, a lot of people were living, you know, their socialization was through Zoom and similar sort of apps. So the thing about Zoom was that you could see them on the screen, you could hear them, but they didn't feel like they were in the same room as you. So if you have people who are likely to be living in isolated communities, maybe for months at a time, not seeing any human, it would be great for them to actually feel like someone else has joined them in the room. And, you know, this just socialization and everything else makes perfect sense. And one of the reasons why there wouldn't maybe not be so much movement outside of the habitats is that the Martian environment is very harsh. You know, it's extremely cold, very dry. You'd have to go out in full, you know, spacesuit essentially. And if you spend much time out of doors, it's also a relatively high radiation environment because you don't have the radiation shielding that they say the ozone layer gives us on Earth. So it's likely that people will live mostly in their habitats or in specialized vehicles or something like that to protect them. Anyway, that's so the question is, firstly, the benefit for the Martian inhabitants, and secondly, the benefit for doing experiments which would allow us to develop better terahertz communications devices. I'm sorry, the terahertz comes in because terahertz gives you the bandwidth.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you next. So can we just get a comparison, right? So actually, I think you hinted at it at the start. So say a 5G signal. Okay, 5G signal uses what band, do you know?
There's a variety.
3 to 300 gigahertz.
300 gigahertz. And what would be the kind of the bandwidth and the through? What would be the speeds that you would expect to get at that, at the upper limit?
Yeah, the maximum limit that we can reach is like 100 gigahertz at the time, like
on 5G.
5G.
Okay, but nobody gets 100 gigahertz. No. I have 5G at home. No. It's amazing. It has changed our life because we were living in terrible broadband land, and I get 100 megabits per second, 200 on a good day, but you know when the weather is bad because it really goes down, right? Yeah. So, but what would be the speeds, the upper limit speeds of the terahertz communications, these 6G signals that you're talking about?
Yeah, we are expecting like terabit per second data rates.
So a factor of 10, typically.
So 10...
10 times, 10 times higher.
10 times higher at optimal conditions.
At optimal conditions.
Yeah. Right. And we know that wireless communications in a vacuum are much more efficient than in this heavy, dense atmosphere that we're in on Earth. And then the idea is that, so we know that, and we know that from various space research and things like that. And the idea is then that on Mars or somewhere else that is in this kind of very less dense atmosphere, not a high amount of moisture content, the signals can go further and faster and aren't bound by the issues.
So the physical conditions are much better for them on Mars than they would be here.
Okay.
So if you want to have this telepresence kind of example, you need to pack a whole load of huge amounts of data, and you need to do it with what's it called, short latency. So in other words, you don't want to be seeing someone talk about moving and then you there's a delay, you know, it's very off-putting.
I know. So when you mentioned the Zoom example, every person most people on the planet have experienced like Zoom. It, don't get me wrong, it's a great technology and it's a great platform, but you know, it can be frustrating.
It can be frustrating. Exactly.
The idea is that high bandwidth communications,
high bandwidth, low latency.
Low latency communications would take that out of it and would allow you to do an awful lot more because you could transmit much more data, which is where you're getting into the world of holograms.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
And holograms aren't really practical in 5G conditions. It's just we can't pack enough data to make it believable.
Yeah, so it's the same with the virtual reality things, which has come on significantly in the last 10 years or however long, the kind of this wave of virtual reality is. But it is... still take you out of
most
it.
Virtual reality things, you still have, you've tethered to a headset, so you don't have the limitations to, you know, maximum wireless capacity, essentially.
Yeah. Okay, I want to hit you with a big question now. Let's say I was listening to this going, the lads are just talking guff. Why is this important? Either of you. Maybe both of you answer this. Why is this important? Takshila, why do you think this is important?
The reasons that were not mentioned before, like the communication between habitats to make people not to isolate inside the habitats. So it's important in that way. And in telecommunication aspect, so in Earth, previously we investigated terahertz communication in extreme condition, like what happens if it's rain and snow and a dust storm. So in island like in weather, so the dust storms are not like in common, like in whole Earth it's in the same way. So on Mars, its dust storms are really frequent, and it is really makes a severe effect to the communication signals. So investigation, getting the terahertz communication on Mars, so it will give some kind of advantage for the future Martian communication.
I suppose another thing, so exactly as you said, Takshila, so the Mars gives us an opportunity to test it in ideal and not ideal conditions. Ideal conditions when it's clear air, and not ideal when there's a dust storm blowing around. The other thing about it is we've talked about in terms of packing more data. So if you have, say, a big event, and you have people streaming, say a concert, and they're at the concert, then the devices place a huge drain on the local wireless communications infrastructure. So if you want to provision that in a reliable way, you need new technologies to do that. So 5G would struggle. And the belief is that if you were able to have, say, 6G enabled devices, that, you know, you would have excellent video quality while you're at an event. So let's say it's a big sports or music event. Then the overall experience, if you like, is that much better. Particularly when people will be looking for, if you like, value added content, like, you know, augmented reality on top of video streaming, on top of actually being physically there. So you can imagine just how immersive it could become. And if you have a system like that, which is, you know, say predicted for the future, we can't do it yet. But if we want to do if we want to kind of enable that to happen in 10, 15 years' time or whenever it becomes practical, we need to do the research now. And the research that we're doing at the moment is simulation-based. So it's basically computer-based experiments with mathematical models and so on. But eventually, as you said, Rob, we will need to move to devices. And at that point, the more practical things like, okay, it works in principle, but does it actually, can we actually get, you know, the performance on the silicon, as you know, at the level that we need. So if you're a computing student, embedded device programming and technologies is going to be important. We've kind of hinted at the kind of the big data mining, mathematical stuff and statistics. And I suppose the other thing then is just the physical intuition. Like, what if a signal is degraded, why is that happening? So all of these are kind of useful disciplines to bring in.
So, yeah, I mean, it sounds, so you're not testing on Mars right now.
No, unfortunately not.
No, you're not. So it is all model based. But, you know, maybe in a few years, Bernard, you might be putting on your spacesuit.
Yeah, they'd be measuring me up, I expect. But, you know, I think it will be eventually. I mean, there are plans to go to Mars, I think, from 2040 onwards or something like that. I know that it's the next frontier, if you like, for space exploration.
So this and projects like this, so we start off talking about Vistamilk. This is Vistamilk project, but it has now kind of moved into a whole other area as you learn about the more physical properties of things.
It's the nature research in the sense that it touches on different things. And you wouldn't necessarily make the connection between, say, Mars and Vistamilk, but because we were asking research questions, we were saying, well, how do we test or how do we develop? And we sort of say, well, if you were to move to a different scenario, what could you learn from that scenario that you could bring back to Earth?
Yeah. So not today, not tomorrow, but the European Space Agency or NASA or whatever other future agencies, when those missions happen, and when I'm sure you're plugged into the, because you're plugged into the European Research Network anyway, ye have a body of work done on wireless communications in a non-dense atmospheric conditions. Yeah. And hey, this might be ready to rock and roll for, you know, a 2040 Mars mission.
So if you...
And maybe Bernard might be going, but actually you might be going.
Yes.
I'm not trying to put cheers on you now, but you know, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So certainly the idea here is that for any kind of big mission, there's a huge amount of research and development needs to happen beforehand, and it can happen decades beforehand. Mm. So we're talking in 2022. In say 2042, there might be a mission to Mars, for argument's sake. But a lot of the work needs to have been done ahead of time, so that if they start to build habitats, for example, they know how to enable them to stay in contact with each other. And like, for example, if you're going to build habitats on Mars, you're probably going to need to use Martian materials. You can't just bring it all from Earth. So that will introduce...
Yeah, you can't pop into Woody's and buy a bit of wood, like, or just send up a truckload of bricks.
So that would introduce its own kind of research challenges. Yeah. But to even to get to that point, you need to do the basic modelling-based research first. And then you can figure out, well, if we were to go, what is the next thing? And what's the next thing? And that is the nature of research.
Yeah, I there's about a million questions going off in my head now, because I read a book recently about space research. I'm a space nut, and I'm talking about kind of self-replicating robots to do an awful lot of work, which again is, what you're talking there about kind of low latency communications is going to be a major factor for them. That might be something we'll put a pin in, that, because we might come back to that another day and do an actual science fiction podcast. That would be good crack.
We could do that, definitely. Yeah. Thanks, Rob.
Takshila and Bernard, if somebody wanted to find out more about Vistamilk and the work that you're doing, where should they go?
Yeah, our best place is the Vistamilk website. So you can go there and search for the publication. And we have... written a blog post for every research that we done in the way that everyone can understand, and you can use the social media as well. So we have Facebook pages and Twitter profiles, so you can follow them, and also we have Walton Institute website as well, so you can search for our profiles and learn more about it.
So the social media channels will be, I suppose, just search for Vistamilk. Would that be
Vista, which
is Vista Milk? So go for that. And then I suppose there's probably, you probably said profiles on the Walton Institute page, and probably the new SETU website as well. Your Bernard Butler and Takshila Vedige, you're both up on that, and that's spelled Wedage. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and did I pronounce it correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to insult you bringing on the podcast. Lads, thanks so much for talking to me today. I do appreciate it. It sounds like fascinating work, and I wish you all the best with the rest of your PhD, Takshila. And if you want to find out more about the podcast, machine_podcast on Twitter. We have stuff up on the new website, but I don't know where that is yet because I haven't investigated it properly. we talk about communications and I don't even know where it is. But anyway, we leave that for there for now. Gents, thanks very much. I appreciate it, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon, and maybe we'll talk about robots on Mars.
We can do that too.
I should fade in David Bowie music here now. That'd be ideal. Lads, thanks.
Thanks very much,
Rob.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.